Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. Continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks, we are ready for Chapter 7, History Squared, Mount Blackburn, 1977. Here we go. Kicking Karens. Back in Boulder, the magnitude of my Everest failure hit me. I had failed to climb the highest mountain in the world, and for me, there could be no greater failure. All my friends asked me if I had made it up Everest, and I had to reply, no. The situation high on the mountain was difficult to explain, and I tired of trying to reduce it to simple terms. I could tell by the looks in my friends' eyes that they were wondering why I just didn't stomp up there. My understanding of the events was still shaky, and I found myself wondering the same thing. I took off by myself and raged up several local peaks. Feeling powerful again, I charged straight up the fall lines, and when I reached the summits, I destroyed the summit cairns, kicking the rocks all over the area. Nobody saw these tantrums, and it was definitely good that I vented my anger on inanimate objects. The public interest in our 1976 Everest expedition was enormous, and accordingly we arranged a slideshow. The show was in Chem 140 on the University of Colorado campus. This famous room held 600 people, and the place was packed, with people being turned away at the door. Usually a good presenter, I struggled with this one, knowing that I would have to officially explain what happened to my second summit attempt. Bob Cormack was in the room, and I dutifully tooted his horn for making it up there, then mumped past my failure. At the end of the show, I was informed that there were another 600 people standing outside waiting for a second showing. I quickly found Bob Cormack in the shadows and said, "Bob, you've got to do the second show. I can't say all that again. Toot your own horn, man. This is your big chance." Committed to the shadows, Bob just looked aghast at me with Summit Ridge terror and fled. Good grief. The man had just climbed the Big E and he couldn't even talk to his fans. I had to say it all again, then slunk home exhausted and confused. One interesting twist was that when I looked at the Flatirons and the Indian Peaks on the Continental Divide, they all looked low and flat. I had been staring up at Himalayan giants for so long that the mountains of my youth had gone flaccid. My boss at work, Dr. Ernest Hildner, analyzed this correctly and said, "They will grow back." Thus, as my Everest memories blurred, the Flatirons straightened. The mountains of my youth were all that I had left. Sky Sight. I had lived my pre-Everest life without having climbed Everest, and it slowly dawned on me that I had to live my post-Everest life without having climbed Everest. No power of mind or muscle that I could muster could magically beam me up there. I briefly considered quitting mountaineering, but quickly tossed that thought, since that would just be a double defeat. As the calendar crept toward Christmas, I resolved to make 1977 the fittest, most active of my life. I planned to run every day, strengthen every muscle in my body, and climb at least 200 peaks. I had lost the battle, but not the war. In an escape from the Alaskan winter, my friend and climbing partner Dave Pulkey showed up in Boulder for a visit in January 1977. I had climbed New Mexico's Shiprock and several Colorado peaks with Dave and his friend Gary Tandy. Barb and I invited Dave over to give an impromptu slideshow of an Alaskan climb that he had recently completed. His route was up the southeast ridge of Alaska's 16,390-foot Mount Blackburn. I knew Mount Blackburn since I had spent many hours staring at it from the summit crater of nearby Mount Wrangell when I spent the summer of 1964 building a research hut. In 1964, I had been looking at Blackburn's northwest side, and I eagerly anticipated Dave's photos of Blackburn's steeper south side. Our Kodiak projector dutifully dropped each slide with a satisfying clack, whirr, ka-chunk, as Dave's story progressed up a beautiful twisting snow ridge toward a blue-black sky. Alaska! Twitching, I knew that this was where I belonged. This was where I had been successful. This was where I could climb without having to mortgage my life and future. Then the projector dropped the most wondrous image that I had ever seen. It was of a double cornice that somehow hung over the abyss in both directions, and the root crept through the crease between the crests. I instantly knew that I had to climb this ridge, cross that crease, and continue to Blackburn's summit. Late that night, Barb and I pored over our maps, planned an approach largely on foot, an ascent of the southeast ridge, a traverse over both of Blackburn's summits, and a descent of Blackburn's northwest ridge. We would climb the first half in the first half of June. Plan in hand, we slept well with dreams of another Archangel adventure. Could it possibly be so simple? Of course not. Histrionic history. The first thing I did was my usual research on my chosen peak to better understand my adversary. Blackburn is the highest peak in Alaska's Wrangell Mountains and the Worthy Range's most dramatic high peak. Blackburn is the fifth highest peak in the United States, the 12th highest peak in North America, and the peak's beauty has attracted eyes for a century. In particular, Blackburn dominated the view from the Kennecott Copper Mine southeast of the peak. The first climb that fell under my microscope was the historic ascent made by Dora Keene way back in 1912. Dora Keene, driven by a deep desire for the climb, solicited miners from the Kennecott Copper Mine, forged a route up the heavily crevassed east face, and with her partner George Handy, reached the summit of Blackburn's east peak. Standing in cold, cloud, and wind, they saw the ice roll away in all directions. They could not see the west peak 2 miles away, and in any case, believed that they were on Blackburn's summit. On her return, Dora Keene published an article titled, First Up Mount Blackburn, that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. Dora's ascent was a landmark climb done a year before Denali was finally climbed, and that it was led by a woman was another landmark for the time. Dora's heady exploit was way ahead of its era, and many decades passed while climbers turned their attention to other unclimbed peaks in Alaska and the Canadian Yukon. Finally, in 1958, a team that included Bruce Gilbert, Dick Wallstrom, Hans Moser, Adolf Bitterlich, and Leon Blummer flew in, landed on the Nabesna Glacier, climbed Blackburn's northwest ridge, and reached Blackburn's west peak on May 30. The weather was clear when they were on top. They could see the east peak 2 miles away, and like Dora, they believed that the east peak was higher. However, they did not have the energy to make the traverse. On their return, Blummer wrote an article for the 1959 American Alpine Journal titled Mount Blackburn, Second Ascent, in which Blummer admitted that they had only reached the lower west peak. Blackburn rested by itself for a few more years until new USGS maps came out in the early 1960s. The 15-minute Mount Blackburn quadrangle clearly showed the east peak to be 16,286 feet and the west peak to be 16,390 feet. Thus, the west peak was higher and Blackburn's true summit. Thus, without knowing it, the Blummer Party in 1958 had made the first ascent of Blackburn, and without knowing it, Dora Keene and George Handy had climbed the lower summit in 1912. I resolved to climb both summits in 1977. However, there was another historic twist waiting. When my friend Dave Palki climbed the southeast ridge in 1976, he was convinced that he was repeating Dora Keene's 1912 route. As I researched the peak, I realized that Dora had forged a route directly up the east face, and that, without knowing it, Dave had made the first ascent of the beautiful southeast ridge. When I called Dave and told him that his was a new route, he shrugged it off as business as usual for his team of tough Alaskans. I also asked Dave if he had visited the summit of the East Peak. He replied that they skirted well below the East Peak and beelined for the West Peak, which they knew to be higher. Thus, no one had visited the East Peak since Dora and George in 1912. All this confusion only stiffened my resolve to climb Blackburn. While our ascent of the southeast ridge would be a second ascent of that route, no one had visited both summits on one trip, and no one had traversed the peak, going up one route and down another. Barb and I had indeed come up with a grand plan. Now all we had to do was execute it. An important detail for me was that my Blackburn expedition would interrupt my run every day program. So be it. Blackburn was more important than my running resolution. I made a new commitment to run on my first day back from the expedition, no matter how wasted I was. I had no idea of the beating Blackburn would bestow, and how hard this seemingly simple run would be. Birth of the BB-150. Next, I needed a pilot and a team. My choice for a pilot was simple, since I had already flown with Jack Wilson in 1964 on Mount Wrangell and in 1967 on Mount Lucania. Jack now had some other pilots working for him, but he was still master of his Wilson Flying Service based in Glen Allen, Alaska. I contacted Jack and explained our complicated operation. We would need to fly in south of Blackburn, walk in, get an airdrop on a saddle below the southeast ridge, then fly out from the Nabesna Glacier north of the peak. Jack, the master of the Wrangell Mountains, immediately agreed to take care of us. Then Jack added, "So, I can't believe that you're still at this, Jerry." Finding a team was a little more complicated, but still much easier than planning an Everest expedition. When I explained my Blackburn traverse to my longtime climbing partner Rob Blair, he immediately signed on. A professor of geology, Rob was always ready with a fanciful story to match any moment, and he had a bottomless bag of thoughtful jokes. Rob was an excellent technical climber, and schooled in the French Alps, he could yodel. Next, I recruited Roger Gretti, who was attracted to my project's remote, obtuse nature. Roger could recite long passages of Robert Service poetry with about desperate struggles in the Northland. This turned out to be both a blessing and a curse. Finally, I found Jerry Hinkle of Logan fame, who always had a twinkle and could counter Rob's thoughtful jokes with a more banal version. Stated simply, Jerry was the kind of guy you wanted with you in battle. When everybody else was losing it, Hinkle would just crack a joke to keep it all in perspective. With Barb and I, we were five. When we added up our ages, the sum was 150. So we called our crew the Blackburn 150, or just BB-150 for short. United by the unknown, we pared down our kit to essentials and prepared to blast over Blackburn in just 3 weeks. Kuskalana Caper. The reason for my 3-week timetable was that was all my vacation time from work, and since I was still paying for Everest, I couldn't just quit to go climbing. I should have known that such a constraint from the lower world had no place in a serious mountaineering plan to a high, wild peak. Nevertheless, I told my boss that I would be back at my desk by 8 a.m. Monday, June 20. With everything perfectly packed, we flew north to Anchorage on Friday, May 27, and spent the night at Dave Palki's place swapping stories. A climber's worst nightmare, the airlines managed to mishandle Rob's luggage, and Rob stayed in Seattle to expedite the recovery. On May 28, Rob arrived in Anchorage, but his luggage did not. After a flurry of promises from the airlines and borrowing vital gear from Palki, we drove 5 hours to Glen Allen and moved into a little shack just off the tarmac, where we had room to sort our gear. It felt great to be back at this wilderness doorstep. In the familiar hangar, we went over our plan with Jack and Wilson's extra pilots. Jack would fly us one at a time in his tiny Super Cub and land us on a gravel bar southwest of Blackburn that was within striking distance of the Kuskalana Glacier. We would then walk up the Kuskalana Glacier under Blackburn's sweeping south face for 4 days to an 8,950-foot saddle at the beginning of Blackburn's southeast ridge, where we would receive an airdrop. When we gave the pilots the bags that we had packed for our airdrop, I wondered if we would ever see the bags again. Airdrops are tricky, and if this part of our plan failed, we would have to retreat back down the Kuskalana in abject failure. Since we were planning a traverse over both Blackburn summits, we were determined to go light, and we culled several more items from our personal gear and sacked out in the shack. Rob still didn't have his luggage, but if the airline kept its promise, it would show up in Anchorage before morning. Pilots like to fly early in the morning, so I hauled my pack over to the Super Cub at 5 a.m., where Jack was waiting for me. After stowing my pack on the floor behind the pilot's seat, Jack said, "Climb in, Jerry, you know how to do it, but I still can't believe that you are doing this climb at your age." This time I fired back, "Jack, I can't believe that you are still puffing on that pipe. It's going to kill you." Jack ended the exchange with, "This is Alaska. A man can do what he wants up north, which is why we are both here. Hop in." I eyed the tiny space, folded myself double, made the requisite three-move sequence into the Cub, and sat on my pack. As Jack climbed in, puffing on his trademark pipe, I said, "Yeah, I'm still climbing, still training for Everest." Jack just gave me a look, puffed, clipped in, then fired the engine. 30 minutes later, after flying by my old friends Mounts Drum, Sanford, and Wrangell, I watched Blackburn approach. Peering over Jack's shoulder, my first impression of Blackburn was that the mountain was huge. Singular and stoic, the massif dwarfed all competitors. Blackburn immediately demanded all my focus and attention. The closer we came, the higher the mountain loomed above Jack's tiny Cub. We flew past Blackburn's north and east sides, and I madly clicked my camera at the rush of views. There was the unclimbed east ridge, the badly broken east face, and our southeast ridge, which looked long and hard. I gulped, knowing that if a route looks hard from a plane, it's really hard. After our scenic swoop, Jack coasted down the Kuskalana Glacier, past its snout, and headed for the trees. He circled his chosen gravel bar, touched down on the Cub's balloon tires, and rolled to a graceful stop near an old mining shack near Nugget Creek. I unfolded my cramped legs and stepped onto the ground in my leather double boots that I had used on Mount Wrangell in 1964, Lucania in 1967, painfully extracted from my dream climb adventure on Foraker in 1975, and worn to the South Col in 1976. Feeling overdressed, I stomped around the area looking for clues to my new adventure. The contrast from the ragged ridges I had just flown past and the river bank lined with trees was stark. One by one, my teammates arrived, and our collective conversation crescendoed. Last to arrive, glory be, was Rob, clutching his pack. He had driven halfway back to Anchorage, collected his pack from Keith Palki, who had graciously driven up from Anchorage, returned to Glen Allen, and flown in. After Jack left us alone, we gazed toward the rubbled snout of the Kuskalana Glacier, and falling silent, felt the enormity of the task that we had given ourselves. Our unspoken words were the flowers of our silence. The best balm for an overdose of impending stimulation is simple motion. So with daylight on our side, we hefted our heavy packs at 4 p.m. and started toward our goal. Each in their own world of thought, we completed our transition from living room dreams, travel trouble, and city shackles to the real world of pack weight, river, tundra, trees, lowering skies, a glacier in the distance, and a huge mountain lost in the clouds. After 4 hours and 4 miles, we stopped and pitched our first camp by another old cabin. Except for the distant sound of the river's gurgling and sucking as it rolled rocks with it in its rush to get away from the glacier, all was silent now. We were at the gateway of real adventure, and added bears to our list of things to worry about. We woke to rain on May 30, and I immediately acknowledged our good fortune, since if this weather had hit our flight day, we would have been stuck in Glen Allen, wasting precious time. As it was, we could walk in the rain and make progress. The logic of our luck and the reality of marching in the rain were two different facets. Our first full day on Blackburn began by donning our snow parkas, which were not the greatest rain shields, packing up our soggy camp and hefting heavy packs. We marched up the trough between the Kuskalana's northern lateral moraine and Blackburn's lowest ramparts, until the trough pinched off into an unseen wilderness rock rampage. With effort, we climbed onto the top of the moraine and gazed at our future. Under lowering clouds, we saw miles of rubble-covered glacier, complete with pressure ridges interspersed with rivers of no return that plunged into deadly vertical moulins. The glacier was askew and prompted a memory of the Khumbu icefall. The five of us stood in the cold rain, staring at our route choices through nature's jumbled maze for a long minute. Again, our silence spoke volumes, since I'm sure each of us harbored thoughts of dismay and perhaps even weakness. I know I did. Finally, I broke our awkward muteness with a simple, "Welcome to Alaska!" Then I plunged off the moraine toward the glacier with vigor. Everybody followed. For the next several hours, we picked the puzzle apart one step at a time, and the miles slipped slowly by. We didn't really rest until we reached a place where we could leave the south side of the glacier to reach a little rocky bay, and this became our camp. In spite of the maze and persistent rain, we had made good progress. That evening, the rain dwindled to a drizzle, then the clouds lifted and brightened in a way that spoke of the nearness of great peaks. All we lacked was a view, but we sacked out with hope for the morrow. The morning of May 31 did not disappoint, and we crawled from our tents to blink at the sunny scene. A ravaged wall and mist-shrouded summit rose behind camp, but across the glacier, the leftover clouds swirled to give up tantalizing views of Blackburn's south face. As we broke camp, the clouds dissipated until the view was unfettered, and we struggled to understand the huge, untouched face that consumed much of our horizon. The southeast ridge rose along our right skyline, and Blackburn's two summits formed a 2-mile top to the south face. As we traced our route, we lurched when we realized that we would climb across most of our horizon. Our spirits soared with the clear weather, and we marched on up medial glacial moraines with considerable vigor. We pushed for many hours while Hinkle serenaded us with silly songs. We finally crossed the Fearn line, put on our snowshoes, roped up, and walked up a steepening hill on deepening snow. It felt good to be done with the rubble-covered ice and on clean white snow. Remembering the killer storm that Barb and I had endured below Mount Foraker, where all the snow melted under our tents, we pushed up for another hour to reach a deeper snowpack. Tired, we dug secure tent sites into the slope and had our first taste of shoveling in what we quickly called Inferno Camp. Our compensations were new, spectacular views of two unclimbed peaks on the south side of the glacier. The first to draw our eye was 10-190-foot Castle Peak, and later we would ogle the 10-092-foot Zebra. but my final gaze went to Blackburn. The weather stayed fine through the night, and on June 1 we reached the 8,950-foot saddle where we would receive our airdrop. Hinkle immediately christened our new venue the Flight Deck. The saddle was large, but not huge, and we pitched our two McKinley tents on the Blackburn side of the flight deck to give the pilots the center to use as a drop zone. The views opened and we had our first look up the southeast ridge. It looked long. At 4 p.m., we heard a plane through the clearing clouds. A Cessna 206 appeared, and we eagerly awaited the airborne dots containing our food and equipment. The pilot, one of Jack's assistants, made a few passes to get the range. Then, flying west to east about 300 feet above the saddle, a dot appeared. The vital package sailed, went a little long, but still landed with a poof on the east edge of the saddle. We counted on the soft snow to cushion the landings. On the second pass, two dots appeared. One landed short of the saddle, but the other hit the bullseye that we had marked in the center of the saddle. On the third pass, the pilot got greedy. Turning east of the saddle, he made his final pass from east to west. Three dots appeared. The first two landed within reach, but the third sailed long. Our hearts sank as we watched it fly far past the west side of the saddle. We could not see where it landed. The pilot wagged his wings and was gone. We were alone with our dots. We grabbed shovels, our empty packs, roped up, and scurried after our precious parcels. We couldn't see the packages, just their craters. We were slightly amazed that our bags had dug 4-foot deep craters, then disappeared into them. The colorful streamers that we had attached had disappeared as well. Digging for dots, we extracted our life-supporting food and climb-supporting equipment, crater by crater. We had a little trouble finding the slightly errant east flying package, then went looking for the far-sailing west package. After several minutes of marching down the steepening slope, we still saw nothing. We continued down the slope as it steepened to a fright, looking, looking, looking. Just as we wished that we had brought our crampons, Hinkle spotted the crater. The last parcel had nearly sailed into a crevasse field, but perching on the unreasonable slope, we had it. An hour later, everything was in camp with us. That evening, high clouds streaked the sky and low clouds rolled over the ridge to the east. Feeling expansive to be back in Alaska, I reveled in our isolated position. Our Kuskalana caper was over, and now we were poised to climb. Stay tuned for part two of Blackburn 1977.